Welcome to the Development Policy Centre podcast. In this episode, we bring you the recording of the dinner speech from the 2016 Australasian Aid Conference by Bob McMullen, a former MP and Parliamentary Secretary for International Development and the current Executive Director of the EBRD.
It's really my honour and pleasure to introduce our keynote speaker tonight, Mr. Bob McMullen. Bob is a He served in the Australian Parliament from 1988 to 2010. That deserves an applause as well. Representing Canberra first in the Senate and then in the House of Representatives, holding a number of ministerial and other senior roles. International development has been a lifelong passion of Mr. McMullen. He served as Parliamentary Secretary for International Development Assistance from 2007 to 2010, where he is remembered in particular for his work on disability, climate change financing, and also on water and sanitation. Last time we had a speaker's dinner at the Spicy Ginger restaurant, and Mr. McMullen was the topic of dinner conversation amongst the two of us. And former colleagues of his, commented that it was his passion and commitment to issues of disability and inclusion that made AUSAID one of the first development agencies to create an inclusive development policy. And I think people still remember AUSAID for that landmark event. And from 2011 to 2015, Bob McMullen has represented Australia on the board of the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, the EBRD. We were just chatting about his few years in London and what a nice experience that was for him and his wife, but how happy he is also to be back here in Australia. So tonight, we would really love to hear from him on how that experience in London has changed, influenced, colored his perspectives on international development. So having returned to Australia, Bob McMullen is currently a visiting fellow at the Amy Crawford School. So I'm sure students are really excited to be able to take advantage of his breadth and wealth of experience from all those years. And he also serves as president and chairman of the board of the International Agency for the Prevention of Blindness, so continuing his lifelong commitment to issues of disability. So Mr. McMullen, people that you know have asked for you to consider yourself among friends tonight, friends and supporters, and for you to really speak freely, candidly, and frankly, about your views and concerns for the future of development and aid. Please take it.
Thank you very much, and I've been back in Australia just long enough to remember that I want to start by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land, which I've not done for 4.5 years, but which I'm pleased to resume doing. You realise, of course, there's a conspiracy involved in this. The timing of the speech is not coincidental. People know that if I speak before dessert, I won't speak for too long. Because I have a sweet tooth and I don't want to get into the dessert. So it was a conspiracy. I'm not sure who ratted on me, but somebody did, and it's probably now very well known. But I guess I should apologise to the international guests, because I really want to talk mainly about Australia and Australia's role in development and in the world, and not so much on my EBRD experience, except with one particular aspect of it. But Stephen House asked me to give this speech, and I said, what do you want me to talk about? And he said, well, why don't you begin at the beginning? And first of all, I thought, well, is he talking about the Garden of Eden, or the Big Bang Theory, or Australia's role in start the First World War and guardianship in the PNG? But I assumed he was referring to the fact that I was a member of the inaugural advisory council of the Development Assistance Agency in the 1970s. And That was a great learning experience for me. I served with some great men, and they were all men. Most notably, of course, Sir John Crawford, who was the Doyen of Australian Development Experts and a globally significant Australian. And he chaired that board, notwithstanding that the government changed and we got abolished. But but there were some strange experiences. We went to the first board meeting, and it was a very interesting agenda, and we had a good morning, and then we went to lunch to this most sumptuous, probably the best restaurant in Canberra. It's fantastic lunch. And Peter Walensky, who was also on the council, and I said, after this is really not appropriate, you know, we're dealing with global poverty, we shouldn't be going out to this fancy restaurant. So I said, okay, we won't do that next time. So what they did was they got the chef from the restaurant to come in. And we had exactly the same meal, we just had probably cost more. So I learned two lessons from that. One is that change is not always an improvement. And don't you find in public life people always talk about every change is a reform? Probably not. Some of them are dreadful. Right? Why is it a reform to make things worse? I don't understand that. But anyway, that's the way the coverage is these days. I also learned that you need to be very specific about your concerns for fear of being misunderstood. So there was one other relevant lesson too, which is sort of contemporary relevance, and I'll move on from this after this comment. But of course, that was an experience of the Australian government bringing together the diverse strands of development issues across the government into one agency. And of course, it was within the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. It wasn't always clear it was going to be within the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, because Treasury, of course, had a big interest, because they represented a very big part of the aid program, because of the World Bank and the Asian Development Bank. And there was some, as I understood, this is hindsight, I didn't notice at the time, there was some significant bureaucratic dispute. And for those of you who knew or know of Ralph McClellan, you wouldn't be surprised to know he settled it in a very forthright manner. We went to a lunch at the lodge, and he walked in and he saw the Secretary of the Treasury there, who was Fred Wheeler at the time, and he said, "What are you doing here, Fred?" And that's the question. Fred left. We were in the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. But whatever one thought about Gough as the Prime Minister and his international views, and I agree with most of them, but not all of them, there was no question he saw Australia as a big country, as a country that had a role in the world, and he had a vision for Australia as a player in the world, rather than a timid, small player looking inwards on itself. And that's really the question I want to talk about tonight. Is Australia in the 21st century going to have a vision of itself as a big player, or a small one? And the answer isn't clear at the moment. There are some areas where Australia leads and continues to lead. I'm very pleased that you referred very generously to my views and role in the disability and development debate, but I'm very pleased that the current government is continuing that, and we continue to be a global leader, and I was pleased to get a copy of the latest strategy just this evening. But, and while I was in London, I did a bit of freelancing. I went to the House of Representatives, the House of Commons Committee on Development, which is something we should have in Australia, and talked to them about Australia's disability strategy, and they wrote an excellent report, which formed the basis of a revised DFID strategy, and I attended some other events there, and I was very pleased to see Australia continuing to play a role. So what that says to me is, if we are selective, do the work, do the groundwork thoroughly, we can lead in almost any area we choose. We can't lead in everything, but that doesn't mean we can't lead in anything. You don't have to be able to do everything before you do anything. And that is essentially the question that we have to face. I'm very pleased about the role we play in disability, but I'm not quite sure any longer what our role is with regard to climate change finance, which is one of the other big questions. I'm seriously not sure because we now have a new Prime Minister and I know what his personal views are, and I'm not sure to the extent, it's not partisan comment, I share his personal views. What I'm not sure is whether he's going to be able to do it or not, and that's a key question for the future of Australia's role in the world, I think. So this is an area where I can sort of draw on my ERD experience because, and it's one of the things that has changed in my thinking. The EBRD is a small niche institution. It doesn't lead the world in very many things, but it leads the world in one. It is the most efficient and effective and successful investor and mobiliser in private investment for climate change mitigation. It currently has invested more than $20 billion in 1,000 projects across the region, and with CO2 emission reductions of approximately 75 million tonnes a year. So that is, and the leader of that program, I'm not quite sure how Brazilian gets it, because Brazil's not a member of the ERD, but he's a very good guy, and I suspect he's a dual citizen. But he, Josué Tanaka, he is globally regarded as a world leader. And I was pleased to be a critical part of the board that endorsed that strategy. I say critical because what I found was that we were doing terrific work, but two things were not being done. One was I wasn't convinced that we were properly measuring the carbon emission reductions, and I'm not sure we were properly assessing the price we were paying per tonne of carbon emission reduction. And I think now we've got the first one right. We still haven't got the second one right because I don't think we like the answer, but I'm not sure about that. But it is world-leading work, and I don't see why Australia can't be playing a bigger role in that. Similarly, I don't see why the Asian Development Bank can't be doing more in that area. But one of the questions is, you really, ultimately, you're going to need a carbon price for that private investment to continue. And that's an issue Australia's going to have to deal with sometime in the near future. One of my concerns since I've come back to Australia, and of course I followed things reasonably closely while I was away, is that there are definite signs of the re-emergence of a small country view in Australia as it relates to development. We had the honour of being chosen as the country that had the biggest fall in A levels of any OECD donor in 2014. You all know about that. No developed country of our size participates in fewer regional development banks than we do. Of course, many smaller countries are in far more of them, and those of you who were involved at the time will know that I was actively involved both as Parliamentary Secretary and then subsequently as the Prime Minister's envoy to Africa in the campaign to get Australia to join the African Development Bank, which we should do, and we had bipartisan support for it, but it has evaporated with all our activity in Africa. Now, it's not really for me at this stage of tonight to comment on whether we should resume that, but it is just frustrating to see the shrinking vision of Australia's role in the world. We are ignoring the challenges and opportunities in Africa. I'm an optimist about Africa, essentially because when you look through the rest of the 21st century, or the rest of the first half, but anyway, the world's going to need people, we're going to need more food and more minerals. And the part of the world with the greatest capacity to increase its production of food and minerals is Africa. And there's no country more capable of providing assistance to them to do that than us. Now, because we have ACR, we do a lot. So that's the Australian Centre for International Agricultural Research, for those who don't know. We do a lot to help agricultural production. But I found, when I used to visit Australian, African countries on behalf of Australia, and we had programs that were quite welcome when we came to, we've got to do this. We have this particular interest in maternal and child health, and they'd say, that's very good, thank you very much. And we have this scholarship program that's going to bring lots of African students to Australia. Thanks very much. Thank you very much. One of the other things. Now I've finished and they'd say, what about mining? Every time. Almost without exception. Not that they wanted us to teach, that they wanted us to teach them how to dig holes in the ground. A, they knew that, and B, the companies did that very well. They wanted us to help them with the regulation of mining, with the land registration, with the environmental regulation, with the health and safety activities. And we started to do that. And I think it was not only a significant contribution, it enhanced our reputation in the region. Because there's lots of Australian mining companies there, and most of them do very good work. But not all of them do. And occasionally, we run some reputational risk, and I'm not really being critical of the industry. It's a controversial, difficult industry, and things go wrong. And we want to be part of the solution to those problems, as well as the beneficiaries of the investment. And I think one of the saddest signs of our shrinking vision is that we're not engaged in Africa, and we're not really looking to play a similar role in mining to the one we play in agriculture. As a country, we don't have a development finance institution. People know I've written about that, so I won't talk about it anymore. We don't have yet the internationally respected institution like the ODI or CGD. I'd love to think the Development Policy Centre is going to be it, but that's for time to determine. But we should be putting some more effort and resources into that. So my principal message, and I've got a secondary one, my principal message is to you all that we need to think big, to be proud of what we've achieved as a country and not to be afraid to share our good fortune. My secondary point that flows logically from that, I hope, is to all of you who are here, whether you're from the academic community, from NGOs or other service providers, that we shouldn't be afraid to stand up and fight for more and better aid. Because we never have. Those of you who are younger than me will be aware that in 2014 there were big cuts, and they were greeted with a whimper, not a roar of protest. But I remember, so I can be even handy, but I remember when my party was in government in 1987, and I was the National Secretary, as you heard. And we had an economic crisis, and the Foreign Minister offered up the aid program for cuts as part of the solution. Maybe he was right, maybe he was wrong, that's another issue for another day. But And I was sitting there at the centre of a political communications web waiting for the response. And there was nothing. Nothing. And I've spent a quarter of a century now talking to aid organisations, encouraging them to be more actively engaged, not to be so timid in speaking up. And why I so much welcome that this conference is growing and developing and being so strongly supported is that it should provide that unity of purpose that should give people more courage to speak up, to think big, to be brave, not just to hope for the best, but to advocate it, to work for it, to call out for it, and to challenge the way things are done, and to intellectually, as well as more grassroots manner, to speak up for the fact that we're the 12th biggest economy in the world. We have an opportunity and an obligation to do more than we do. And I hope that as this conference goes on year after year, we'll see more people using it as a platform and spinning off from more activity that says Australia should be doing more, we should be doing it better, we should be choosing selectively the areas in which we can lead and not being afraid to do so. And I thank you for the opportunity to come and reintroduce myself to you all, my first toe in the water of public life back in Australia, and I've enjoyed it very much. I enjoyed the two sessions I was able to get to today at the conference, and I look forward to your questions. Thank you very much.
Change you think they brought about to the discourse Because I recall, if I'm not wrong, that when Labor came to power in 2007, they suddenly put the Millennium Development Goals up on the front window of AusAid, as it then was, because the previous government hadn't given them any attention whatsoever. And I remember the Labor government did really push the Millennium Development Goals a lot. And recently I was at a meeting with another former Labor Member of Parliament from the Victorian State Government, who's been very much, John Thwaites, who's been involved in big international networks promoting the sustainable development goals through Monash University but other broad networks. And I just wonder if you have any comments about things that could be done, you know, even by former politicians, not who are no longer in the system, but and other people, of course, in the policy-making area, because I think it does change the game quite a bit, and I'd be interested to know your reflections on this.
Thank you. Let me deal with the first one about the quality of debate. I think one of the advantages they have in the UK, and it's to some extent a country of three times our population, roughly 2.5 times, is while they have some of the world's worst media, they have some of the world's best as well. And you can get some very interesting media debate going on. At the moment, they seem totally obsessed by whether they want to be in the European Union or not. And I cannot understand why people think they should leave. And I can't understand how people can argue that they should leave, but then they still want to keep the UK together, because that would blow it apart. Scotland will leave the next day. So it doesn't make any sense to me. So any country can get positions distorted, but in the UK there is that leadership agreement across the parties about 0.7, and for all the Osborne austerity, that has been ring-fenced and protected consistently every year. It's not without criticism, both within the wider community and within the Conservative Party, but he and the Prime Minister have been very strong in defending that. And haven't come under real political pressure about it, because the opposition shares the view. So it is enhanced. But I think across Europe, the debate around development issues is, there's many aspects of it very helpful, but it is to some extent also in retreat, because you find the voices of division and Ms. Le Pen and some of the other forces that are raising serious questions, which are being challenged because of the crisis with the Syrian refugees. And it's a very, very serious issue which Europe has to confront. So the debate is being hijacked a little bit, but I do think it's in a better place than it is here, and one of the reasons is that they have the House of Commons Committee, which does air issues and does produce reports, which I think is a very desirable thing. On the Crawford School, they've got one person, that's me. I'm not sure about anybody else yet, because I only know about two others so far, so come back and ask me next year, I'll give you my views. Helen, on your question, I think I really know and like John Thwaites, and I'm aware of some of the work that he does in the environment area out of Monash. You have to be careful as an ex-politician, ex-minister, that you don't fall into the trap of ignoring the complexity with which you had to deal when you were a minister, and focusing on and seeing all the simple answers now that you've left, that everybody used to advocate to you when you were a minister, and you knew you couldn't do them. So I don't want to be smart at my colleagues' expense, but I do think there is the room for people after they've been out for a while to reflect on lessons that can be learned, and I'm hoping to be able to do some of that, as well as doing things in development, to do some of that in sort of politics and governance around the school. As to whether the sustainable development goals are having a beneficial effect on public discourse in Australia, I've only been back 6 weeks, but I haven't seen any evidence of that yet. Established the 0.7 and campaigned around it very hard, and David Cameron, when he was trying to position the Conservatives as, this is his phrase, not mine, no longer the nasty party, it was one of the things he did to try and soften the image of the government. But to his credit, he has not, he didn't just say it, he's done it and he's stuck to it. And I think that's, as I say, to his great credit. I was very proud that our government, when it came in 2007, announced a target of significant increases and started down the road of doing it. But I'm not, first of all, for reasons which I don't need to talk about, that's one temptation I will resist, we didn't stay in power as long as we might have to implement that and to embed it. But also, I'm not sure that we communicated the case either in advance of doing it or while we were doing it as well as we might have done, and that's to some extent my fault. I was having too much fun doing it to get out explaining to people why we were doing it, and perhaps that is part of it. I don't think it's because Australia's a meaner and people in the UK have private contribution data doesn't support that, so I don't think that's the case, and it's for others to judge whether we are meaner at some other levels, but I don't think Australians on the whole are. What constitutes better aid is an enormous question, and I think that's essentially what the conference is about, and people have been raising all sorts of issues around that. And I've only heard one or two parts of that. I was very impressed, of course, with the first keynote address this morning, which spoke about the role of aid in the Sustainable Development Goals. And then Professor Kim and her colleagues this afternoon. And I think the second part of what you say is how do we communicate it better to Australia? That I think is something where I want to give a bit of thought and perhaps actually have something to say in the future about the communication of that. But what I think we really need is more voices speaking up about the case for what we were doing and what we should be doing. And as I said before, that's one of the things I really appreciate about this conference, and which I hope it goes from strength to strength. With regard to disability, one of the things that I have found in developing countries is, well, two interrelated things. One is the proliferation of disabled people's organisations in those countries. Little organisations that you'd never hear about. For a period between when I left Parliament and when I went to London, I was working in a voluntary capacity for Disability Rights Fund, visiting countries, advocating policies on behalf of people with disabilities. And I went to Bangladesh and I met a little group of people who were out of Chittagong, which is the world's capital for the destruction of ships. And the conditions are appalling because of all the chemicals. People are dying as they work. And this was a little voluntary organization, had no money, no support, but they were there fighting for the rights of people with disabilities as a consequence of these horrific working conditions. And the Disability Rights Fund was able to give them some small amount of assistance. But what I found, what that encouraged me, is that people with disabilities will find ways to speak up, and you just need to facilitate it. The other, and it does, that doesn't cost much money. Right? The Disability Rights Fund, I think, gave those people $1,000, $2,000 or something, and it transformed the organisation, because up to that they had nothing. And the other thing is the Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities. You shouldn't underestimate the power of that and the obligations that it imposed, firstly, on countries to develop policies on behalf of people with disabilities. Second, there's a clause in it that says that those of us who have development assistance programs have to structure them to take account of the interests of people with disabilities. And I'm not sure how many people outside Australia and a couple of other countries have actually read that clause, but we should be advocating it. But a lot of, I found in countries there were, people had confronting issues in different ways. And in Uganda, they have seats in Parliament set aside for people with disabilities. Now, I don't actually think that's a terrific idea, but it was a great way to get those voices heard. They had a number of four or five, I'm not sure how many, not hundreds, but some. And it guaranteed that they had a voice Now, they all happen to be in President Museveni's party, you'd be surprised to know. But nevertheless, they were there, and they were there because he wanted them to be there on behalf of people with disabilities. Let me now only partially resist the temptation that you offer me, Professor. I regret the fact that Auslan is rounding up in defect, but I don't think it's the biggest issue that we face as a country in terms of going forward. You can run a decent aid programme from inside a bigger ministry, you can run it from a specialised agency. I don't understand the conservative fascination that has gone from Canada to New Zealand to Australia about abolishing independent aid agencies and folding them back into the ministry. I've never understood the ideological underpinnings of that argument, and if it had been up to me, I wouldn't have done it. And I think probably, at the very least, it was an example, going back to my earlier comment about not all change being an improvement, but if you ask me what were the top 5 or 10 things an incoming government should do, I'm not sure that re-establishing the agency would be the top of that list. If there are more important questions. But I think I've had some discussion, as you know, with people in Korea because we shared an office in the EBRD for all those 4.5 years. And we worked closely with Korea on a number of other matters, both in my time in the Parliament and afterwards. And I think the idea of an independent agency for a country with a rapidly developing and emerging development programme is a good idea. Whether in the long term you should do that, that's a matter for judgment and for the Korean political process. But I think if I were you, I would do it. Not necessarily because of the Australian or US or UK experience, but just because I think it is a very good way of providing a focus for the intellectual debate you need to have around the character of your emerging development programme. I think Korea is doing some really interesting things, most of which I agree with, but not all, and I think it is a very important debate to be had. So I regret the change that was made. I don't think it was either necessary or desirable, but whether it's an egg that should be unscrambled is an issue for others. Thank you.
You have been listening to a podcast from the Development Policy Centre. For more information on our work, visit our website at devpolicy.anu.edu.au. To join the conversation on Australian aid, Papua New Guinea and the Pacific, and global development policy, visit our blog at devpolicy.org. At the blog, you can also sign up to our newsletter for all the latest updates or connect with us on social media. Thanks for listening.